Alan Kohler here, and I'm talking to Tom Cregan, who is the CEO of EML Payments, which has been mostly a gift card business, powering the technology and the financial technology behind gift cards. But it's now trying to diversify out of that business because most of the gift cards are issued in shopping malls, which are having a very difficult time at the moment. So they've bought a business in Ireland called Prepaid Financial Services, which is a reloadable card business as opposed to a once-off gift card. And they've managed to pick it up for a fair bit less than they first offered, which was a very interesting situation. So I've started the interview talking about that and what happened and what PFS means to EML, and then move on to the prospects for EML's business and its relationship to buy now, pay later companies. So here's Tom Cregan, the CEO of EML Payments. Well, Tom, I just wonder if we can start with the Irish acquisition you've just made, Prepaid Financial Services, partly because I think it's core to your strategy going forward, but also it seems to have been a fascinating series of events where you announced in November that you were buying them for £226 million, and now you've actually bought them, or you bought them in March, the end of March, for about £100 million less. So take us through what happened.
Well, mate, I think the main thing was we didn't actually seek to to use COVID as a rationale for just trying to lower the asset value. It was more the circumstances of COVID, I think. So when February, at the end of February, the EML malls business, really started to get impacted by COVID with social distancing and mall closures. And so we were seeing our revenues being impacted in that part of our business. And had we done the deal the way it was originally structured, we would have had $165 million in debt coming out of that. And that wasn't a scary number when our pro forma EBITDA for this year would have been $65 million, and then with growth on next year, so we might have had a 2x leverage, which didn't seem like a scary number. But come COVID and all the uncertainty that threw up for us, we went back to the vendors and said, look, I'm just not comfortable doing this deal with any debt at all, because we don't know what we don't know. This was in the early 2 or 3 weeks of March, so that was probably when uncertainty was at its highest.
So just at that point, early March, or when late February, the deal was off, was it? The original deal that you'd announced was finished.
No, so the original deal was continuing on, but we and they had both had walkaway rights, so we were waiting for regulatory approval, and so that the longer that regulatory approval took, the longer it gave us the ability to kind of renegotiate the deal. We didn't get regulatory approval until late March.
It turns out you were really lucky. I mean, goodness me, if they'd come up with the regulatory approval quickly, you would have ended up buying it for £226 million.
Correct. If regulatory approval had come through in a month, which wasn't likely, but if it had, then we would have. The flip side, I think, they're probably regretful sellers in some respects, because the impact of their business hasn't been as significant as they would have thought, and in some respects they probably wish they called my bluff, but we.
Also, they accepted your lower offer because they thought they were in trouble.
They back in the early part of March, I think everyone had a lot of uncertainty around what the impact was going to be, short and long term. And so we'd already raised the money in November. So our position to them was, we can walk away from this, no harm, no foul. EML lives to fight another day. We'll have, $300 million in the bank, and we can look for other acquisitions, and you can continue running it and sell it again in the future. But I think they were committed to the sale. We'd spent a year working with them on the sale, and I think they were just wanting to get it done at that point. But since then their business really only had a short term kind of impact, and has come out of it reasonably well.
So you've picked up a bargain.
Well, I think it looks that way. I mean, if you can call the money we're spending still a bargain, but it was fortuitous. There's no doubt about that. But had we not restructured it, we would have walked away from it, because I just didn't want to have that debt level with a COVID uncertainty. And then after renegotiating the price to get rid of the debt, we then renegotiated it further down to have cash, because we wanted to have as much of that as we could. So we ended up, we went from a $165 million debt position with maybe 10 in cash to nil debt and 120 in cash. So we came out of it on the right side.
I suppose part of the irony is that if their businesses bounce back, your core business, the mall business, which was 65% of your revenue, has long-term problems, I guess, which possibly the PFS business in Ireland helps to alleviate, because it diversifies you. Is that a fair comment?
Yeah, very much so. Yeah, I think our strategy was always diversification. It was always to move to getting the majority of our revenues out of reloadable or recurring products as opposed to gift. I think gift had got too large for us. It was, as you said, 65-odd%. So the PFS acquisition was always part of rebalancing that and moving us forward in that direction. Given where we are now, it was even a more timely move, because malls were impacted in the short term, but will be impacted, I think, in the next 12 to 24 months. So having that part of having the PFS business within EML, really it fast tracks that transition and allows us to focus on those growth avenues, as opposed to just waiting for when malls eventually recover.
Can you give us a profile of the PFS business and what it does for you? What direction it takes you?
All of their business is in the GPR, the general purpose reloadable space. And
what does that mean?
Recurring program. So a gift card would be a single use card. So I'm giving it to you and you're using it, once or twice and then discarding it. A reloadable card is one that is akin to a de facto bank account. So it'll be used over and over again by the recipient, whether that recipient is in, is a customer of one of our gaming partners or a customer of one of our salary packaging partners or one of our fintech partners. It's a card with a multi-year expiry that will be loaded and used multiple times over its life.
Are they reloaded by the customer or by the employer in the case of the salary packaging?
By the customer. So our customer is Macmillan's or
Sport. Oh, I see.
Or so it's all corporately funded. They're not personally funded.
So it's more of an annuity revenue stream, is it?
Yeah, like a gift card. A gift card is a volume game. So you'll sell one gift card. If you sell a gift card for $100, you'll make $6 in terms of total revenue streams akin to that. But the way of making that six again is you've just got to sell that card again and again and again. So, we sell 10 million, north of 10 million a year of gift cards. And the way to grow it is to grow 10 to 11 to 12. It's a volume game. Whereas in reloadable, a customer in the salary packaging area would make us, just one customer, one cardholder, $60 a year in that kind of area. In other verticals, similar. So you've got more revenue per customer, but you're not having to continually sell to that customer every month. The customer's got a card, and then they can use it as many times as they want over its life.
So what is PFS's recurring revenue?
So their main verticals. I mean, EML was already in the reloadable space, but more in verticals like salary packaging and gaming and others. They just had a complementary set of verticals. So their largest one is banking as a service, so digital banking, which is providing the platforms and the transactional capabilities for different neobanks and challenger banks, fintech banks, depending on what they want to call themselves.
Who are their customers for that?
all sorts of guys, companies like Correos, which is the Spanish post office, which acts as a quasi-bank issuing programs to customers. Their largest customer is in France. They're not household names, but the customer in France is called PCS. Then you've got a whole raft of other ones, Fintonic, eCredo. You've got a lot of these organizations that are out there trying to take on the traditional banks in these different countries with transactional products. And they use PFS for that, and that's about 45% of their revenues. And then the other 45-odd% is government payments, welfare payments. So the UN is one of their customers for refugee payments. They've got contracts with the Home Office in the UK, as well as all of the local market authorities, all the local councils. So EML didn't have a real government presence. We didn't have a big presence in welfare, and nor did we have a presence in the kind of banking as a service area. So that was good for us, and we've been able to start reselling those programs across the rest of our markets, which is going well. The part of their business that will be impacted, probably for the shorter term, is multi-currency cards. So a lot of the, on the back of your Qantas frequent flyer card, not that anyone uses them anymore, you've got the card on the back, which is a travel card. That was also a part of PFS's business that we didn't do, and that will just take travel to start to recover and normalize, and then that will bounce back. But in the short term, that'll be impacted.
Does that banking as a service business have a kind of an inbuilt sunset on it, in the sense that as these neobanks get bigger, they build their own platforms and run them, and if they don't succeed, they drop out, so that they're not long term? Is that possibly true?
No, I think that they tend to. They're very much front end focused. So even the largest ones in the world, so Chime would be one of the largest ones in the US. That recently had a $5 billion funding round. Revolut, which is one of the largest in Europe. Last time I checked, they had more than 15 million customers. So they focus all of their energies on the front end of the business, which is the customer interface and user experience. And they're more marketing companies than they are payments companies, because the payments are normally always outsourced. Whether it's to us or to other entities, so they tend to stick to what they're good at, which is the acquisition and the retention of customers versus the payments and the regulatory piece.
Right. Okay. Fair enough. Now, I think the gift cards are still 40% of your business, or so. Do you have more diversification to do?
Probably on a product sense. Not really. I think that we're pushing for the next 2 or 3 years, really heavily into more of the GPR space and more into what we would consider kind of disruptive businesses. We think that COVID and a lot of the market research would suggest that COVID has driven a deceleration in the usage of cash and an acceleration in the use of digital payments. And if we look at that, and then we look at the sales pipeline that we're getting, we really think that the pivot for the business will be more towards disruptive fintech businesses. So whether they're companies that are challenging the traditional banking system in kind of banking as a service, or we've got customers that are challenging the lending industry that we're working with around the world. We've got companies that are looking at insurance as a disruptor. So we want to be the home for those disruptive fintech businesses, and that'll become more of our focus over the next 3 years. The gift is still a strong business when it recovers. I mean, it was making $22 million a year in EBITDA for us, but the recovery of that is out of our hands. So we're just managing our customers and working with them as they recover. But every in 20 some odd countries, different economic recovery, different social distancing rules, all sorts of stuff makes it a bit of a patchwork quilt. So we've just got to see how that, you know, how that recovers over time.
Did you miss a trick with the buy now, pay later, which has taken off, obviously, and now has got a bit too big to even for you to jump into?
Well, we were a tech provider to some of those companies. So we wouldn't have been the buy now, pay later company itself, because I think they're a business to consumer model.
Oh, okay. So you're in the back end of some of those businesses, yeah. Are you?
Yes.
Yeah. So right. Which ones?
We launch next month with Sezzle in the US. We manage some online purchases with Zip in Australia. We launch a company called Scalapay in Italy and the UK. We've got others that we're talking to. So we're more of a tech provider to some of those companies as opposed to having the expertise to actually do them. The receivables management and all the things that they're doing. So yeah, if we can partner with more of those companies, going forward, then that's just another I wouldn't say it's a vertical for us, but it's just another use of our technology, another application.
Can you explain to us exactly how that works? Because I think obviously a lot of investors are interested in buy now, pay later, and it's pretty hot at the moment. They'll be interested to know whether you're possibly going to go for a ride with these businesses or not.
I think how it works. So if people will be most familiar with the with the Australian landscape where Afterpay and Zip. Launched and went through their initial launch was more around QR codes at the point of sale. So they were transactions that weren't running through the Visa or MasterCard network. They were running through, through the use of QR, which made a lot of sense in the early days because it's lower cost, but it's also, they had the time to do the IT integrations with all of those merchants to be able to process QR codes. So they had, they had the time to get that done. But I think, now with the success of those companies, you can see in the US, it's a land grab for merchants. It's the same in the UK, it's the same in Europe. So they don't have the time to do these integrations into the point of sale systems with these merchants, which could well take, 12 months or longer to do. So the way they're accessing them is accessing them through the Visa and MasterCard network. So in the US, what Sezzle will have is a the customer will have a phone. The phone will have a digital card on it that when the customer goes to the merchant, instead of scanning a QR code, they'll tap their phone and then they'll scan the phone. So it uses the MasterCard Visa network to initiate the transaction. Therefore, it gives them kind of ubiquitous presence in the market. It also enables them, if they want to do buy now, pay later transactions in merchants that are non-affiliated. So, they will have merchants where they've already got commercial, terms with, and they'll have some that aren't. But as we start to transact in those ones where they're not, well, then they kind of, then the buy now pay later company follows that on and can call that merchant and can say, listen, we're sending a lot of transactions your way, we'd like you to be part of the network. So that's where it fits in that part of the
But it sounds like with Sezzle you're only a part of their back end, not you're not exclusive in some way.
But we're definitely a tech provider that enables them to, and enables them to achieve their goals, which is maximizing transaction value and in as many places as possible. But from that point on, from when the transaction is initiated and settled, the rest of the functions are theirs in terms of marketing and customer management and receivables and all that kind of stuff. I mean, that is a specialist business, and they're the parts that they would focus on, because that's where they derive the most value from.
Sezzle's actually set up to use the Visa and MasterCard network, but Afterpay and Zip are not. I just wonder what your role for them would be.
It would be a similar role. I think so. Afterpay are doing that in the US. If they haven't launched it, then it can't be far away. And I don't know of any of their plans for Australia. But I think in the US they'll be up and running pretty quickly.
Right.
So. Yeah, but I think my view is, I think all of them, whether they're the known provider, the known players or up and coming players that are coming to market, they'll all have to have a similar application, because once one competitor has it and the next competitor has it, then at some point it kind of becomes table stakes for them to have it, I think.
Can you give us a sense of the competitive environment for your business and PFS's business? When PFS or you pitches for a business such as the United Nations one or the British government and so on, how many firms are you pitching against?
Yeah, our competitors, because we're operating in different verticals. Most payment companies that are in the prepaid space similarly operate on different verticals. They'll tend to just focus on different verticals, and sometimes that's a strategic decision, and sometimes that is that's the way the business evolves. So that happened with us in gaming, for example, where we launched that in Australia in 2014, and then Europe in 2016, and America in 2019. So you part of what you're doing is developing expertise within an industry, credibility within an industry, reference clients within an industry, and then you're able to go and hopefully take that internationally into other places. So our competitors would be quite niche. So in a US sense, there's a company called Marqeta, which is a privately held a payments platform business. That might soon be going public if the word on the street is true, which would be interesting for us, I think. So we would come across them a little bit in the US. In Europe, we would come across a company called Edenred, which is a large French services company that owns a prepaid business. Wirecard was a competitor of sorts until they blew themselves up, so they've disappeared from the scene. In Australia, we don't really compete, I wouldn't think, with Inju, but Inju is an Australian bank that has a prepaid business, but most of what they focus on is government payments and indigenous welfare or assistance cards. So competitors are different in each country, but and they're often going to be specific to a niche as well.
Yeah, right. So, what's your sort of forward guidance situation? You gave some guidance in your most recent update. What's perhaps you could just run us through it?
Yeah. So we had guidance for FY20, which we pulled in the first few weeks of March, and then we won't give guidance for FY21 probably until January. And the reason we won't do that is that 30% of our gift card EBITDA is generated in that 1 week prior to Christmas. So that's obviously a big swing factor, and we've got no idea how that'll perform this year with COVID and all of the all of the impacts of that, so we're going to wait to get through that. Once we get through that, come January, we'll have a pretty good idea of what the full year will look like, because there won't be any other large swing factors that could really move the needle that much in the second half. So guidance is suspended, but come January, I think we'll then provide that for the year.
So, what does the gift card business feel like to you now?
I would think it's all over the place, to be quite honest. So look at it, you know, Canada, for example, malls until recently were closed due to social distancing. In the US, with Simon Malls, which is one of our largest customers, they're open, but there's no staff there to sell gift cards because the company will, the malls are open, and so you as a customer at your own peril can go into the malls and go into the merchants. But given the rise in COVID cases there, that they don't have their own staff behind the service centre selling it because they don't want their own staff to get it and then be sued for being put in an unsafe, you know, work environment. So that is all dependent, I think, on how the cases move in the US in the coming months. One of our largest customers in the UK, Into Properties, went into administration last 2 weeks ago. And so they're trading and they're not going out of business, but customers probably don't buy their gift cards because they don't know what happens if they go out of business. The monies are totally safeguarded, but they probably wouldn't know that. So they will, you know, those volumes are going to be hard to recover. In other countries, you know, Germany is back to about 50% of what the pre-COVID volume was. And that's off a 100% decline. So that was fully 100% off in April and almost the same in May and kind of got halfway back in June. Poland and Italy are about 70% recovered to kind of pre-COVID levels. So it's very much a patchwork quilt of how these things are recovering. So the more time we have, I think the better, the more we learn about how they're responding, and that just gives us a bit more time to think about what the recovery looks like and how long it looks like. Is it a and recovery might be never getting back to 100% either, right? Because I think, you know, COVID has absolutely changed customers' buying behaviours and pushed a lot of it to online. So we, you know, the new normal for EML might be 80% of what we were doing in that segment. It could be 90%. You know, we don't know that, but time will tell.
That's what I was going to ask you. I mean, the COVID stuff is short term, but the long term future of shopping malls is looking pretty challenging as well, isn't it?
Oh, I think they were. It was a low growth vertical in the sense that, you know, if it grew 1-5% a year, you know, that was successful for us because that's, you know, it would track in line with retail sales and the like. But it was a highly profitable business. So we always saw gift as the kind of cash cow, if you like, that was funding our investments and our acquisitions into the reloadable space. And so for that reason, it played its part and it's successful, but it'll just become, instead of kind of the core of the business. So, you know, without COVID happening, we would have achieved our guidance this year, which was, you know, 40 to 41 mil. So, you know, let's say it's 40 million just for ease of math. 22 million of that, is linked to malls. So, you know, effectively 10% of GDV is 2.2 million of EBITDA. And so the thing for us for next year is, for this current fin year, is what does that recovery look like? If the recovery is 30% of the volume we were doing in the malls, then you'd make 6.6 million in EBITDA and be down 16 million. If it's 50%, if it's 70%, I mean, they're the swing factors that, you know, that we don't know. Now, PFS obviously means we're shielded from that, you know, from that loss because we've got the earnings and the EBITDA coming in from PFS. As well as growth in the rest of the business. So I think that we will grow on a net basis in FY21 despite malls being down, and then it's really malls become almost almost instead of being the core of the earnings, it becomes kind of the optionality of the earnings because if we do 30% this year, 40% this year. And you do 60 or 70%, 80% the following year, then you're picking up, you know, 8 to 10 million of EBITDA as it in FY22 as it recovers. So it goes from being our core to being our optionality, which is a fair juxtaposition in a pretty short period of time.
Well, it's been good to talk to you, Tom. Thank you very much.
I appreciate that. Thanks.
That was Tom Cregan, the CEO and Managing Director of EML Payments.